Welcome to The B Word, a podcast about humans, organizations, behavior. I'm your host, James Healy.
1816 was known as the Year Without Summer. A year earlier, a giant volcano named Mount Tambora on the Indonesian island of Sumbawa had exploded in the largest eruption Earth had seen in tens of thousands of years. The eruption was heard 2,000 miles away and caused a prolonged global volcanic winter, with average temperatures across the world falling by almost 1 centigrade. On the shores of Switzerland's Lake Geneva, volcanic winter manifests itself as an unseasonably cold, wet, and dark summer, much to the frustration of one eclectic group of holidaymakers gathered in a lakefront villa. Legendary romantic poets Percy Shelley and Lord Byron, together with Byron's personal doctor and Shelley's 18-year-old fiancée Mary, sought to pass the time by telling stories. Inspired by the dark and gloomy weather and the strange, eerie light, Byron challenged the group to craft a ghost story, with a prize for the scariest. To everyone's surprise, the teenage Mary won. She told of a recent nightmare in which a brilliant scientist created a replica of a human from dead flesh and brought it to life with lightning, before despairing of his creation. When the story was later published to great acclaim, Shelley titled it Frankenstein, or the Modern Prometheus, in a nod to the hero of Greek mythology. Like Prometheus, to which we'll return later in the episode, Shelley's Frankenstein is a cautionary tale about scientific hubris and the consequences of the unchecked pursuit of knowledge and power. Today, more than 200 years on, it's a story that seems more relevant than ever. Like Frankenstein's monster, artificial intelligence is both terrifyingly strange and hauntingly familiar. Eerie and uncanny, or reminding us of ourselves. Like it or not, the Dr. Frankensteins of our own era, Altman and Amadei, Hinton and LeCun, Musk and Zuckerberg, have unleashed their creature on the world. What does this strange and compelling development mean for individuals, for organizations, and for society? What are the implications of the uncanny similarities between artificial intelligence and human intelligence? How do we best adopt and adapt to this exciting, terrifying new technology? To explore these questions and more, I'm delighted to be joined today by Paul Gibbons as we discuss our new book, Adopting AI, The People First Approach. Paul, good morning. Good evening. Welcome back.
Good evening. It's 8 p.m. in pitch black where I am, and I guess you've just left the beach.
You're not wrong.
Good stuff. Good to talk to you.
Always good to talk, Paul, and great to have you back on The B Word. Our previous episode a couple of years ago on change myths was one of the most popular that I've done, so I'm sure people are very excited to hear your voice again. Let's get down to it. We are here to talk about our new book, Adopting AI, The People First Approach, which is out, well, by the time the listeners hear this, is out already. Why did we write this book, Paul? Why did you set off on this adventure to write a book about AI?
Well, I felt a year ago when I started scratching down ideas that there was very little written on AI and leadership, AI and culture change, AI and workforce upskilling. It was all over, but I didn't find any of it in the books. I bought, like I do when I do all of these book writing things, I bought the 30 books that I think I ought to have to read. And I didn't find anything there. And initially it was going to be called Leading in AI. And then, you know, as these things do, it's like catching a tiger by the tail. It sort of takes off in a different direction. So I felt like something needed to be said about the human side of artificial intelligence. And I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to say. It was kind of Leading AI, something else. So I started, and then I took the summer off. And then when I came back from the summer, I started writing like full time in September or so forth. I think I contacted you in October. And you forgot to duck. What did you think when I asked you to write it? I know you just started a business, right? So you're like, you have other things on your mind, but what enticed you about all of this?
Well, I think, and this comes through in the book, right? To echo what you've said, there has a lot been written about AI, and there has a lot been published about AI, both in book form, but also research papers, also papers by big consulting firms. And it just felt to me like everything about the human side of AI, everything about the adoption side of AI is basically a lift and shift from existing change management content.
Somebody did Control X, replace SAP with artificial intelligence.
Right. I'm sure we'll get into this. You and I, if anyone has listened to the Change Myths episode, they will be well aware of this. You and I are somewhat critical of what we'll call traditional change management and how successful that is in adopting traditional technology. But quite aside from that, I just felt like taking that approach totally misunderstands AI and totally misunderstands what's fundamentally different about AI. So I wanted to get that message out there, and your timing was perfect.
Well, I mean, here's the thing for the book. So I'm going to pin you down, right? And you're going to pin me down a little bit. So I'm going to pin you down. Okay, so why isn't, you know, AI adoption and a big programmatic change centered around AI, why isn't it SAP? SAP systems cost $50 million, right? $100 million, whatever they cost, right? So that's not the difference, right? So what is the difference from your point of view?
Well, I would say there are only two reasons. The first reason is that traditional change management misunderstands humans, and anyone who's read either of our previous work or listened to either of us on this podcast or many others will be familiar with that. It assumes that providing people with more information changes their behavior. It assumes that if you tell people why to do something, how to do something, they will do it. That's not true.
Yep.
More fundamentally, it misunderstands AI as well. And I think this is at the core of the book, right? The assumption that AI is just another computer system totally misunderstands the nature of it. And we can get into the details of why it's not like another computer system, but how that manifests itself from a user perspective, it's unpredictable. It's really good at stuff you wouldn't expect it to be good at, and really bad at stuff that you would expect it to be able to do in a heartbeat. People will probably be familiar with the strawberry example. Until fairly recently, ChatGPT 4 was unable to answer the question, how many R's are there in strawberry? Now, a 5-year-old could probably answer that. A system that is being marketed to the world as PhD level intelligence surely should be able to do that, but it can't.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing, and I'm kind of okay with that. It doesn't distress me in the slightest that it makes these kind of ridiculous errors. One, because it's new, so it's a new technology, so it's not as if, you know, the Ford Model T, well, actually the Ford Model T was 40 years after the invention of the automobile, but it's not as if the first automobiles or even the first computers, you know, I used the first computers in 1978, and they ran like shit. And even if you were using computers in the 80s and 90s, the blue screen of death, and you had to reboot the thing every few hours. And, you know, the number of times Word crashed after I spent a day working on something, and you'd lose it all. I mean, is it something wrong with the expectations that they expect this thing? Is it sort of a counter to the hype? So there's so much hype around it. We feel we have to say, oh, look, isn't that stupid? Yeah, well, it just wrote me 5 pages on quantum gravity. And, you know, it's all very quick to point out, you know, things like strawberry and problems like that. But to say in this kind of binary way, and I think we get to that in the book as well, is that that's a typical way that people think about something which is unnuanced and kind of, dare I say, thuggish. They're either stupid or they're not. It leaves no room for it being brilliant in some regards and it being, you know, subhuman in others. And I think there's this idea that human intelligence is the template to which all intelligences should aim. I think that's just such a ridiculous supposition. If you think about it from a kind of universal scale, why would it be that the things that our brain can do exhaust everything that's possible for the universe? And the answer is you'd be ridiculous to think that, right? So why, if we draw a long list of things that we call thinking and problem solving, creativity and moral reasoning and embodied reasoning and understanding the physics and the physics of the world and all the things we go into in the book, you take this long checkbox, say there's a dozen things that you want an intelligent thing to. All right, it doesn't do all of them, but who said it should? I don't do all of them very well. So I think these are just really fallacious arguments, especially for technologies, you know, effectively when, well, I don't know, when the large language models, they sort of birthed in 2019 or 20, GPT 3.5 was the end of 22. So we're now almost 2.5 years into the sort of quote unquote Gen AI revolution or something like that. So anyway, I don't take these guys very seriously, although there, you know, there are some smart people around. We just saw a book today came out by a guy who's a very fine scholar in other areas, a guy called Bent Fleevberg, I think he's Danish, who is an expert on large projects, large infrastructure projects, you know, multi-billion dollar infrastructure projects and why they go wrong. And I don't doubt for a second his scholarship. I relied a lot on his scholarship in the book I wrote, Science of Organizational Change. But he wrote a book called Artificial Ignorance, and I'm going to have to buy it and dig in out of respect for the man as a scholar. I think he's probably full of it. I think he completely misunderstands the technology and what it does, but I'm going to have to dig into it out of, you know, respect for him as a thinker. And same with Gary Marcus, you know, I mean, he's another guy who says this thing's kind of stupid. It's not really thinking and everything like that. And I feel, you know, he's credible enough or at least well-regarded enough. So I should be able to jump in there and do battle with them, because I think they're wrong. And I think Arvind Krishna, our IBM CEO, said the same thing today. He said effectively some stuff in a long, long blog post I just commented on LinkedIn, which basically said the same thing. Anyway, I want to do battle with these guys. The book doesn't do that, right? The book doesn't go into the technical details. It's like 3 pages out, right? Of what is human thinking and, you know, why would we expect this thing to match us in all areas? Do we care that it surpasses us in some and it's inferior than others? And we use the example of a cephalopod, or what do you say in Australia? Cephalopod intelligence, which is an entirely different kind of intelligence, not quite to human intelligence, but yet in many respects differently structured than us, and it can do some things that we can't do. Sharks do things that we can't do. Birds do things that we can't do. So I think we're in the midst of an interesting debate. And you know what? I also think this debate has a sort of a sense of not being really relevant. Like, there's a stage in which this business about 2 hours and strawberries, I don't care. If cancer researchers are working on understanding the pathways in oncogenesis and developing, you know, I don't know where the treatment modalities will lie, whether they're be in the immune system or mRNA treatments or whatever they'll be. But if they're working on that and they're working on that credible, and people who are working on, you know, drug discovery or cancer research and using AI and saying this thing is amazing and it's speeding this research forward, would I really go to a guy like that as a serious scientist and say, yeah, but I can't count the number of hours and strawberries, buddy. So no, of course you wouldn't. So, I mean, I think these are trivial discussions. I dare I say, I want to be harsh, like trivial discussions for trivial people, right? I don't really care. I'm sorry. I rather rambled on then, but what are your thoughts?
Look, I'll pick up a couple of things there. I think starting at the end, I think you're absolutely right. The use cases for AI broadly, and I think we should be careful about our terminology here as we are in the book. We are using the term AI to encompass large language models, but not just large language models. There are other types of AI which are better established and used for other things. But some of the use cases around things like AlphaFold in biochemistry research, as you say, cancer research, cancer diagnosis. I'm not going to rattle off all the use cases, but there are dozens and dozens of really profoundly transformational, in the true sense of that word, use cases for AI technology. Now, I just used the word technology, and I think that the word technology is at the heart of the problem here. AI is definitely a technology. It has been developed using computer systems. It runs on computers, but it is also not a technology. And I think it's best thought of as an intelligence rather than a technology. And you talk about cephalopods, you talk about birds, you talk about other animals also being intelligences. They absolutely are. They can do certain things we can't do. We can do a lot of things that they can't do. And I think if we start to think of AI in those terms, we can then look past some of these trivial errors and focus on how to adopt and how to adapt to AI?
I think the thing that makes it an intelligence and makes it different is if you start to use your CRM system, the CRM system doesn't, I don't want to say it doesn't learn at all, but it doesn't change and learn and evolve and grow over time, right? And that's the sort of promise as we engage in dialogues with this intelligence, even the stuff that we've been working on using it for research. You know, it got cleverer and cleverer, every time I used it. It challenges you to ask better questions, to think more deeply about things, think more creatively about things. And it changes along with you. I mean, the example we give in the book, I think, is a fun example about the marketing department, where you could either bung in some turnkey solution into the marketing department and say, okay, we're 30% of you are fired, right? And, oh, bravo, you've reduced your headcount by 30%, and, the efficiency. That misses an entire trick. The entire potential of it is for it to transform what you're doing in marketing. But if you try and plug in a turnkey solution and force users onto using a turnkey solution, which may optimize social media, it may optimize content generation, it may optimize multimedia content and all of that, you'll miss the opportunity, which will really transform the entire strategy and processes of your marketing function, and without necessarily having to lose a lot of people. So anyway, I think that's the difference. Is it's one of the definitions of intelligence, that it's adaptable and it's flexible and it learns, right? Those would be on everybody's top 10 things that it has to be able to learn. And it does, without question. And it does. And I think 5 years from now, we'll see that, my AI will become very personal to me. It will learn as I learn. When we started using it, I started asking it, I would ask it dumb questions like, okay, I thought I had this table, page worth of data on something or other, AI law, for example, pages and pages of notes and everything like that. And I would say, put it into a table, and I use it. And that's a very simple question. But by the time that I'd been using it for 6 months, we were going deeper and deeper into issues, doing much more interesting and complex things. So as the user gets better, me, the technology gets better. And I think people also miss that when they talk about kids, students, erosion of critical thinking skills if they use AI. And of course it does. If you ask it a question, you do Control-C, Control-V, paste it into your homework and hope the teacher doesn't notice, of course you're not learning anything. But that's not the kid's fault. That's the teacher's fault for asking the sorts of questions. And teachers will learn, right? They'll learn. I can ask harder questions. I can ask them to think more, where the facts of the case are the ante, and sophisticated, creative, analytical reasoning is what human beings can do with those facts, synthesize, create. And I think that's the potential. So I don't think it's the teacher. I don't think it's the kid's fault. I don't think it's the technology's fault. As we say in the book, I think it's the fault of the education system, which kind of asks people the sort of questions that are amenable to multiple choice answers. Well, of course, you're not going to get smarter if you ask AI to do a multiple choice test for you, right? But does that mean that AI is messed up? No, it means you have to stop asking stupid multiple choice questions and assuming that that's a substitute or a proxy for learning, which it's a very bad proxy for learning. What do you think about that? AI is the learning aspect of the intelligence is what makes it different than SAP, which doesn't learn, doesn't adapt.
I think that's a huge part of it. I also think that unpredictability that I talked about, which is often used as a stick to beat it, is also a huge feature. And what that unpredictability means is it's hard to know necessarily what the use cases are for it. So if you install SAP, right? So if your CFO takes the decision to upgrade your ERP system and you're going to have the latest and greatest SAP, if you're a financial accountant, it's going to change the way that you do things, but it's not fundamentally going to change what you do. You're still posting journals, you're still preparing month-end statements, right? There is a set of parameters within which you operate in your role, and that's what the new system will let you do, for better or worse. It's not immediately clear what AI can do. And maybe as time goes on and we get more used to it and we get more experience with it, maybe it starts to become clearer. But at the moment, you need to experiment, because it might well be able to do something totally unexpected. There are risks and opportunities with that. The risks are Again, when you install the new SAP system, you don't have to worry that your financial accountants start producing marketing videos.
Exactly.
Or that your marketing team start producing month-end accounts. These aren't things that you need to lie awake at night worrying about. Given it's such a blank canvas, that is something you've got to worry about. You need guardrails. But fundamentally, you've got to create the culture where people can experiment, where they feel safe to try new things, where they feel safe to collaborate. And that is not new news. That's been said about cultures of innovation in business for decades. But one of the things that is new is that traditionally, the big blocker to that is the fear of failure. Every business in the world pays lip service to failing fast, test and learn. Sure. Very few of them do, right?
Right. Yeah.
Traditionally, if you run an experiment and it doesn't work, that spells trouble. Perhaps the same is still true with AI, but there is an additional challenge, which is what if your experiment succeeds? What if you run this experiment, which demonstrates that you can do this thing that currently takes you 60% of your time and you can do it in 5 minutes? Do you feel safe? Do you feel comfortable telling your boss that fact? Or are you worried that that's going to result in a thank you, get your stuff? What we're seeing at the moment in a lot of organizations is secret AI use. So even if the organization hasn't yet rolled out AI tools, plenty of employees are picking up their phone and looking at Claude or ChatGPT.
Let's share the numbers, 50% roughly.
Right?
Yeah. And some very large percentage of that 50% are submitting AI work as their own without telling anybody. You know, so like, yeah, this is not like SAP, right? It's not like people are running around, you know, you got this $50 million SAP system and the guys over in marketing and the guys in R&D are trying to twist the SAP system to do some crazy stuff for them and running experiments. Of course they're not, right? That's what makes it different. One of the things that makes it different.
On the education point, Paul, I think I'm right in saying, but in the 15th century, there was similar angst, because in the 15th century, a chap called Gutenberg had just invented the printing press, which allowed the mass publication, I don't think it was that mass back then, but the publication of books. And there was great angst among the educated classes that this would be the end of thinking, because you could now just read the answers in books.
Yeah. And it's also, the printing press, like AI, is a subversive technology as well, right? I mean, if you believe some kind of postmodern narrative about knowledge and power or something like that, you know, those with the knowledge have some power. Those with the power get to say what knowledge is as well. It's the other side of that. So the printing press, it was seditious. It was subversive. And there's probably no doubt in my mind, although, you know, I'm not a historian of, you know, the modern era, the scientific revolution, and the Enlightenment, but I would imagine a serious thinker about history would think the printing press was one of the enabling technologies that allowed this great idea that we shouldn't cede our power as human beings to clergy and kings, and that we too could possess knowledge and we too could reason for ourselves. And I think it's subversive in that way as well, as we can do things that, you know, are, you know, reserved for the right people. Science is another example. I mean, God, I almost want to get back into science. It's just such an exciting time. I want to tell listeners one of the things I learned. This was back almost 9 months ago now. I was thinking about what's the most utopian view on AI. And I had this intuition, maybe I'd read something, but maybe it was an intuition that it was going to be scientific discovery. That was going to be the important stuff. You know, the stuff about it is going to answer your emails for you, and it's going to manage your calendar for you. It's going to manage your social. I don't give a shit, right? I mean, okay, that's great and whatever. And those are fantastic use cases. And some that are not transformative use cases. So I began to research AI and scientific discovery, and I ran across a paper written by a bunch of Chinese authors, like 30 of them, who were serious scientists in, you know, every scientific discipline you wish to name, from neuroscience to climate science to geoscience to agriculture to high energy physics, across the thing. And this paper set out solves how AI will be transformative in each of their disciplines. And it was the best paper I've ever read in my entire long, long life as a researcher. And, you know, I began life as a scientist. It was the most fascinating thing I've ever read, because they weren't talking about like 2040 or 2050. They were talking about 2028. They were talking about the sorts of things this could do for scientific discovery you know, not in our lifetime, but like in this decade. And I was absolutely blown away by the potential of it. Now, listeners, you know, who aren't scientists or David, without going into each of the individual technologies, we sort of dip into it. And this was like a 50-page paper, right? So we didn't recapitulate everything that's in it. But one of the things that's interesting about scientific discovery is that the invention of the telescope and the microscope are seen as two seminal things. What they enabled us to do is they give us an extra sense organ. So we didn't know that there were these things called cells. And we didn't know about the processes by which cells metabolize toxins, keep out waste, you know, how they convert, you know, oxygen to carbon dioxide. We didn't know any of that stuff. We didn't know that diseases were caused by bacteria. Anyway, there's a thing called a microscope, and it allowed us to see another world. And every five-year-old who's gotten a microscope or a magnifying glass, you know, will look down at their arm and think, wow, look at that. Once you're able to see things differently, you're able to construct entirely different hypotheses, create different experiments, a whole new deeper understanding of the fabric of the universe. So that's a long time ago. And then microbiology was born, and microbiology is a whole new science that rose out of the invention of the microscope. And that enables to basically cure, you know, a numbers of infectious diseases, you know, probably save, I think, 2 to 3 billion lives. Antiseptic practices and antibiotics probably save more humans than any other stuff. That's the germ theory of disease, right? I think it's the same thing with the telescope too. You know, when you point it away, you were able to see like, oh, wow, those things are planets too. So the Earth isn't the only planet. So if the Earth isn't the only planet and the moon isn't the only satellite, maybe we're not. So these things just open up new vistas now. So how does AI do that? Well, one of the things it does is nobody can see a petabyte of data. None of us can see a petabyte of data. And a lot of the processes that are interesting in nature, whether it be metabolism or whether it be in neuroscience or whether it be in climate science or all these complex systems, have petabytes and terabytes and exabytes and yottabytes worth of data interacting with each other in a complex way. Now, we can't see that shit. We can't even imagine an exabyte. Never mind being able to see patterns in the data that tell us something about the causal relationships, about what's happening with what. So this is something I think is starting to happen, but I think it's going to accelerate. And it may accelerate in areas like cosmology and higher energy physics and climate systems. That's one thing. And the other thing I think that's amazing to me is if you think about cancer, you think about how many people, different kinds of researchers in the world have a piece of the cancer puzzle. Well, immunologists, oncologists, radiologists, internal medicine specialists, biochemists, molecular biologists, I could name maybe a dozen disciplines. They all have a little piece of the science of the cancer puzzle, right? Do they talk to one another? A little, right? But they talk at human speeds at conferences and papers, right? And each one of those disciplines might have between 10 and 100,000 papers a year. That's the sort of volume of scientific discovery. If you're interested in oncology, I can't remember. I probably asked GPT at the time, how many papers are on oncology? See, being able to knit together insights across these disciplines, allowing them to cross-fertilize and generate hypotheses that just humans just can't do because of the physicality of the siloed human nature of hypothesis generation and hypothesis testing across a dozen disciplines. And the anti-level text, because I bought one, I had a sister who was very ill. I bought the Handbook of Internal Medicine, right? It was written by Anthony Fauci. I just discovered that, by the way. This is its 16th volume. It's 1,800 pages. That's the anti. I mean, that doesn't allow you to be a practitioner of internal medicine, not by a long ways. That allows you to sort of get your foot in the internal medicine door. And if you think about all these dozen disciplines, all with 1,800 page anti-level texts and all with hundreds of thousands of papers being published a day, that is something that AI can and should be able to help us with. So without going into specific sciences, that for me is the great white hope for science. And that's the stuff that will matter. Now, are we doing enough of that? And, you know, are we doing too much email and social media autoresponders and all that kind of shit? Yes, we absolutely are. So I would like to see, you know, but scientists are slow, right? As well. I mean, I met a very senior scientist. He was in his 50s in an AI workshop that I was running in, and he had never used it before. You know, and he's a very accomplished guy. And he was in this workshop. So he used it for half an hour and he was blown away. he was like, holy shit, what else could I use it for? I said, well, you ever done a literature search? How long does it take you to do a literature search if you're writing a paper? He's like, I don't know, 3 to 6 months. I said, well, how about it? He can do a first draft of it in 25 minutes. How about that? And he's like, what? You kidding me? You kidding me? I said, yeah, I'll do a literature search for you. You know, maybe less than 25 minutes, maybe five. And he was like, I can't believe it. What else would I do? And, you know, anyway, a scientist, when was that? That was 2 months ago, was blown away by the potential for this thing. So I think we ain't seen nothing yet when it comes to science. And it's not that I want to be dismissive of the business use cases. The interesting stuff that we say in chapter one is, what can we do that would be a testament to our intelligence and its intelligence and the co-intelligence there? What problems could we try to solve? Not freaking self-driving cars, you know, not superpowering cyber attacks, but what human problems could we point this thing at and to begin to make progress in order to make this thing a better world? And are we pointing it in that direction now? You know, a little, not enough. Do you want to say something about that? Because I think that's something that came to us in the last weeks of writing the book, is this idea about having dystopian and utopian scenarios, something like that. You want to jump in there with that kind of perspective on things? I can read them out, by the way, if you don't want to read them out. I have them in front of me, just in case.
Well, I think I want to stress to listeners, first of all, for the last 20, 25 minutes, you've heard very much the utopian view. And we do credit to that in the book. We definitely start with that. We are also realistic enough to acknowledge it's not a given that we end up at utopia. And I think that's one of the key messages of the book, is the answer to this is not determined. The answer to where we end up is very much based on the choices that we as organizations, societies, and individuals make. And having started with the utopian vision, we devote the final, I think it's the final four chapters of the book, to ethics, governance, law. And I think that fact in and of itself should make clear to listeners, there is a dystopian version of this. And I think I saw you, there's a LinkedIn comment or something, you described the book the other day as like a celebrity death match between Sam Altman and Gary Marcus, which I think is a neat way of putting it. Throughout, we are constantly wrestling with the utopian versus dystopian view. And I think it's the most interesting question facing humanity, right?
I think it is too. We get this right, and we're going to get and we get a better world and lots of, well, we said a lot of problems to solve, but yeah, we create a better world for us all. Do you remember the first of the militarized minds versus supercharged science? Do you ever tell people what militarized mind sounds like? That's the sort of science dimension of the scenarios. Remember that one?
I think a lot depends on how we use this, right? As you've already said. And unfortunately, most transformative technologies in the last 50 years, 60, 70 years, certainly, have come out of the US Department of Defense. So whether or not the Pentagon has done the research, the Pentagon has funded most of the transformative technologies. People aren't generally aware of this.
And made the economic foundation of Silicon Valley as well. Yeah.
Right. This is the first one that hasn't necessarily come out of DARPA or one of those Pentagon adjacent programs. It's come out of the private sector.
That's interesting. That's true, actually, isn't it?
But that doesn't mean the Pentagon and other defense departments around the world are not all over this. So autonomous weapons systems, it's great, right? If you can use AI to target and fire weapons, wow, what a benefit on the battlefield. I'm not sure that's necessarily a benefit for the rest of humanity, though. And so that first dimension of utopia versus dystopia very much comes down to, hey, do we point this thing at curing cancer or the sustainable development goals, or do we point it at really, really effective drone targeting, or, and I don't even know if these things are real, but the kind of the robot combat dogs that I've seen videos of that allegedly Israel is using. I don't know if it's
that ain't nothing. In one of my presentations, I have a picture of the T-100 Terminator, which I think you see in Terminator 2. It's a sort of early prototype before Skynet and before Judgment Day. And then I show one that the U.S. Army is messing around with. And, okay, you could spot a difference, but it's not a big difference. You know, they look alike, and autonomous weapon systems are upon us. And what's scary about that for me is that even with drone, so I always think about the history of war, right? You know, back in the day, 50,000 years ago, you wanted to kill someone, you need to take a club or a knife, you need to get up there, and you need to get their viscera, their blood, their broken bones covered in it. You need to put your own life at risk. But with artillery and siege weapons, and we've become progressive. We've been able to kill people at a distance. But even a drone pilot today, if he's targeting, I don't know, some poor country, Afghanistan, let's say it's been beaten up by so many of us, right? He can see people on the ground. At least there's a sort of human in the loop. And at least, even if there's not human accountability, because he's obviously answerable at the chain of command, it's not as anesthetized. But if you take him out, and what you have is a fleet of these things that are operating autonomously without, you know, then war becomes economic. It's like, how many of these things can I build? Now, war has always been economic, but it becomes more like, fewer of my populace I put at risk. You know, if you look at asymmetry in war, how many of us die versus how many of them die. We, you know, the war in Iraq killed 100,000, 200,000, depends on who you ask, 100,000, 200,000 people. America lost a few thousand, right? Those kind of asymmetries. And AI-powered military technology will allow those kind of asymmetries, I think, which to me are very frightening, very, very frightening.
Well, look, we will stay on this dark territory for a moment. We won't dwell too long. But you talk about those asymmetries. I often think of the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C. It seems huge when you go there, the huge black stone with the names written of every U.S. serviceman who died. 000. Yeah, 57,000 people. There is no equivalent wall in Hanoi, but the best estimates are between 2 and 3 million Vietnamese died in the same conflict.
That's quite an asymmetry.
You know, that is one dark vision of dystopia, autonomous weapon systems. Funny.
Could it supercharge Ebola? Could some kind of kooky guy in a lab cross Ebola with COVID, get the infectiousness of COVID with the destructive power of Ebola and make some superbug? And, superbugs are pretty easy to release. You know, could something like that happen? Yeah, without the right controls, it certainly could. And are the militaries around the world? Probably have, you know, I mean, there are treaties on chemical and biological weapons. I don't know how much anybody pays attention. I think the United States hasn't signed the chemical weapons ban. In theory, the U.S. could be developing things, and China is fairly inscrutable, so I dare say they could be also. So we don't really know what goes on behind the Great Wall very much. I think there's a lot of those. For listeners, there are 7 scenarios that go from the most optimistic scenarios for humankind, right? Not for business. That's an important part of the puzzle, but it's not the part of the puzzle. What it does to jobs, what it does to human capabilities. There's this question about whether we have machines doing all the thinking and doing for us, whether we become vegetables. We have a picture from WALL-E in the book, so I see if the listeners have children, they'll have noticed this kind of supine, you know, 400 pounds, it's like 200 kilos. Non-Americans, guy sitting in a recliner watching daytime TV, drinking 48-hour slushy, is that what we become? Is that guy? Do we become these supine, stupid creatures, or does it empower us to, you know, greater heights, greater performance and greater heights? And I'm kind of optimistic because I think about what it's done for chess, right? I mean, chess has been, Deep Blue was it 87 or 97, Deep Blue? You have a better memory.
I think it was late 80s. I think it was Gary Kasparov.
And people said, starting with Bobby Fischer in the early 1970s, that computers would kill chess. Gary Kasparov said, this thing is stupider than my alarm clock. And it proceeded to kick his ass. That's actually an exaggeration. It won 3-2 or something like that in the first match, or 4-2. But, and now, of course, no human player can get within 1,000 ELO of a chess bot, which is interesting. That's a whole interesting story by itself. So, what has that done to chess? Does nobody play that thing anymore? I mean, it's computers can do it that much better than us. Why should we bother? Actually, games exploded. There are more than twice as many players now. Grandmasters still fight. There are more chess tournaments now than there were. You know, people can get better faster, which is pushing the rest of the sort of chess playing world up. Magnus Carlsen is the highest rated chess player of all time ever. And he's, I don't know what he is now, 32 or something like that. And what's interesting for listeners, I don't want to nerd out on chess too much, but if listeners don't know the story about how Leela ChessZero or AlphaGo learned to play chess by itself. So rather than saying the bishop moves that way, and they tell it like how the pieces move, but they don't talk about position and opening theory and endgame theory, and they don't talk about any of the complexities of chess. They don't supply any tactics or strategies, and they just say, have at it. They tell it, the rooks move this way, the queen moves that way, have at it. And it plays billions of games against itself. And obviously, the first games, it's doing something stupid, it's losing, you know, whatever. It goes, oh, I better not do that next time. That sounds awfully slow, but not when you're playing a billion games a week. It's not that slow. A bit like Human Evolution, actually. And I remember within a week, anyway, I mean, it might have been less than a week, 3 or 4 days, it had taught itself to play chess better than any human player could on the planet. Self-taught. Now, that's kind of like ho-hum. Okay, you guys are a bunch of nerds talking about chess, right? But imagine this. Imagine if we could give it a problem more interesting and more important to humanity than chess and say, here's the objective function. Here's what we would like to achieve. Like end poverty or clean drinking water or whatever the problem is. Yeah, whatever, right? How about it? And simulate, as it's learning to do, lots of ways that this could go. And do that a billion times until you find something that works. Now, if you think about that, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about answering emails a little better and faster. But I'm talking about problems like that where it could teach itself in ways that we can't comprehend. And, you know, as the Go example in the book shows, the guy made a mistake. Everybody thought it was an idiot. 3 moves later, the guy had lost the game. It was like, okay, maybe it's not so stupid. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think to pick up on this, I think the point is absolutely right. What if we point this at some other problem and it replicates that speed and scale of learning? But I think even more fundamentally, just the fact that it can learn is worth dwelling on for a moment. We don't go into a huge amount of detail in the book about the history of AI. There are better, more fulsome treatments of that elsewhere if people are interested. But the crucial point about the history of AI is there were two tracks taken from the early days, 1950s. And those two tracks, one of the tracks resulted in the computer systems that we're all familiar with. Essentially, it used symbolic logic. So if you're using Microsoft Excel or Windows or using any kind of computer system that you're familiar with, even if you don't understand the code, and the code is too complex for most of us to understand, you have a kind of intuition that it basically works on logic. If this, then that, else that. It is mechanistic. It is predictable. It is that kind of cold, hard logic. Now, interestingly, over the last 60, 70 years, we have begun to apply that kind of thinking to ourselves. Many of us use computer metaphors when we think about or talk about the brain. So yeah. We have started to internalize this view that human thinking is machine thinking. The way that the human brain works, the way that humans think, is basically that rational, logical.
It's got a memory module, it's got an emotion module, it's got a language module, it's got a vision module, that kind of modularity point of view.
We have this idea that our senses are a video camera that is on 24/7, everything is recorded exactly as it happened, we just pull the files out of memory. Newsflash, that ain't the way that the human mind works.
No, it's not.
Now, why this is relevant for AI? The other track in AI, what was called the connectionist track or connectionist approach, set out to replicate the human brain. And for decades, it was scorned and it was laughed at. But essentially, what it tried to do was replicate the structure of the brain, loosely, where you have, you know, in the case of the brain, 84, 85 billion neurons linked together in this incredibly complex web of systems of systems. Well, the connectionist path set out to do that, and they created artificial neural networks, and that is what modern AI technology is built on. And it's only really in the last 20 years that that track has come to the fore. Geoffrey Hinton, who some listeners may be familiar with, won the Nobel Prize in Physics last year. He has an undergrad degree in psychology. He, by his own admission, started his career trying to understand the brain. And if you're as smart as Geoffrey Hinton is, the only reasonable thing to do in those circumstances is to start building replicas of the brain, artificial neural networks. By his own admission, and I heard him interviewed a couple of weeks ago, and he laughs about this, he singularly failed to do that. We don't understand much more about the brain than we did. But inadvertently, that work around artificial neural networks created the AI that most of us are now familiar with. Now, what this means is AI, as we're currently using it, doesn't work in the same way as a computer system. It is a computer system, it's built on computers, but it doesn't work in that if-then-else programmatic logic way. It learns. It's exposed to huge amounts of data. It spots patterns. It learns.
Sure.
I am not saying it's exactly like a human brain, but it is far more like a human brain than the computer systems we're used to.
We tried to impose this symbolic sort of reasoning onto it, which came from, well, I don't know, the 1500s and 1600s, from that sort of mechanistic view, reductionist view. We tried to impose that upon and design systems that way. And, you know, we got pretty far. I mean, let's face it. I mean, up until 1980, I mean, that was the only game in town, right? And then once we started to say, well, what is the brain really doing? Just forget about all of that, like the way we think it should ought to operate. But let's like think what it really does. Layers and layers of interconnectivity. And when you hear people talk about neural networks, they talk about layering. We talk about hundreds of layers of neural networks that behave in ways we don't understand. You know, and that's the emergence thing, and that's the unpredictability, and that's the hallucinations, and that's, you know, all of the things that people like to poke fun at are a direct product of the fact that it's doing things that we can't fathom. Like, nobody knows why this thing couldn't count the R's and strokes. You know, why that was. So there's a whole area now, and I think this is interesting too, called mechanistic interpretability. You hear Dario Amodei talk about that, where they're actually trying to go into large language models and neural networks and trying to figure out what they're actually doing. I mean, they can see what they're doing in the sense of less the output is producing, but like trying to figure out in some sort of, it better not be step by step because that wouldn't work, like what these things are actually doing when they're, and it's interesting to me as a former scientist that we've now invented something and we'd have to invent a new discipline in order to figure out what the thing is doing. Like, that's either really exciting or really scary. Like, this whole idea of mechanistic interpretability, like, nobody heard of that 5 years ago, right? But now we've got this new field of research that's trying to figure out how this thing that we've created works. Which is, when I say it like that, I think, yeah, oh shit, that doesn't sound too good. That doesn't sound good to me.
and this is the root of many of the challenges and many of the big ethical challenges. Yeah. There is a whole area of concern, rightfully so, and we talk about this in the book, but about bias. And AI systems tend to be biased. And the reasons for that are various. Partly, they're ingesting huge amounts of data produced by humans, which represents our own biases. AI systems are opaque. It is not transparent at all, as you've just described, why they do what they do. The thing that I find absolutely fascinating is both of those statements are equally true of humans. We are unpredictable. Yeah. We are prone to bias. Our thinking is completely opaque. No one has access to their own brain or anyone else's brain. Yeah. Sure, we come up with plausible sounding explanations of why we did such a thing, but no one actually knows which neurons fired together. So AI is a mirror. We've created this technology that in so many ways, not all, but in so many ways mirrors ourselves. And I think you're right to say it is both absolutely terrifying and hugely exciting.
Yes.
I think... Paul, a question I've been asked a lot, and I want to touch on this because I think it brings a lot of these things together. Yeah. But a question I've been asked a lot by people who've had a look at the book for pre-order, had a look at early versions of it, is what's the cover image all about? Why is a book on adopting AI got some weird kind of classical imagery. What is that?
You know how much shit I got for that image? Someone said, what's that stupid image on the cover? I was like, that's Prometheus, you know, stealing fire from the gods and giving it to humankind. Yeah, well, that's too abstract for a business book. Well, it's more than a business book. It's not really a business book. I mean, it is a business book, and it's not, hopefully more than a business book. But anyway, yeah, Prometheus. Zeus was pissed at humanity, the story goes. He was frequently pissed at us, his unruly things, and he took fire from us. So we starved and couldn't cook food, and we were suffering and wet and miserable. And Prometheus is like, we're not having any of that. He stole it from Mount Olympus, gave it to humanity, and with it, you know, this is when the story becomes allegorical as well. You know, he did this to give us art and science and architecture and engineering, civilization, and all of the things that we were able to do as a result of the beneficence of a gift. He didn't work out too well. Zeus chained him to a rock and he had a bird eat his liver every day, but he would recover overnight because he was a titan. So the bird was at it the next day as well. So that's not very... I think Ulysses freed him, I think, in some versions of the story. Anyway, that's Prometheus, and that's his gift to humanity. And he's a kind of humanistic hero, right? I mean, he's a guy who defied Zeus and said, up yours, buddy. These guys are worth something more. So there's something about the importance of humanity, the potential of humanity. I think that's a very humanistic thing. Humans are the measure of something's worth. And I think AI, I would like to judge it not in terms of the economic wealth that it produces for a small number of people, but what it does for the 8 billion of us that are left sitting around that aren't driving Cybertrucks. So that's the measure. And that's why the book has been, I don't know, some people call it a criticism, humanistic, in that humanism is both gives us some insight into what we think this thing could do for humanity, the potential, the utopian future that we could aspire towards. But it also, humanism is also tells us something about the how we begin to deploy AI. I think that's it. That's why we talk about people first and adoption. And there's a lot to say about that. So that's another three chapters of the book that we haven't touched on, is this whole, how do you do this thing? How do you make it work? What strategies do you use? Why don't we use change management? Well, because it's full of shit and doesn't work for most things. It's certainly not going to work for this. But what's better than change management? We have this framework called adaptive adoption. I think one of the other ideas in the final chapter of that section is learning first. Because if you want to develop this culture of experimentation where people are developing applications and using it from the ground up to transform what they do, they're going to need to, you know, if I may be vulgar, what the F they're doing, right? I mean, they're going to need to appreciate that, you know, when they're using this, they may be introducing ethical risks. There's that example that we probably use too often in the book about the lawyer who's like, ah, this ChatGPT stuff's pretty cool. I got to write a brief, which takes, you know, I imagine it takes a long time to write a legal brief, days, week, 2 weeks, longer if it's a long one, something like that. He just asked GPT, pasted it in. And of course, it has case law in it, you know, so-and-so versus so-and-so in 1984, so-and-so versus so-and-so in 1967 said this. He has all the relevant case law. He put that thing in front of a judge. And the judge and the opposing counsel looked at him and said, none of this stuff is real. These case laws are all made up. I mean, what an idiot the guy must have felt like, right? And talk about using ChatGPT to do your homework. So we can't have that in organizations, right? I mean, we do need some sort of, it's this kind of great paradox, right? We want this culture of experimentation and learning and discovery and self-organization and bottom-up change. And that's all very nice to say. But also, we kind of want people to know what they're doing. And not least, we want them to be thinking about, we want them to understand the technology, but we also want them to appreciate the ethical risks, because when ethical breaches happen in organizations, they happen pretty far down, right? The guys at Volkswagen were a bunch of engineers on the shop floor. The guys at BP were a bunch of engineers at a wellhead. Why is it always engineers? I don't know. The guys at Wells Fargo were customer services representatives. They're probably 25-year-old guys, you know, that opening false accounts, right? These things weren't happening at the very top. These are happening. People in the middle were allowed to, felt themselves empowered to take ethical shortcuts. And, you know, that didn't work out so well in the three examples I gave. So ethics is really part of the the change process, which it isn't with SAP, because SAP is kind of more or less ethically neutral. Right? It doesn't really twist the ethics of an organization, you know, present the board with unsolvable ethical quagmires that they have to wade their way through.
Well, it's why, and I don't want to take this too far, and I don't want to be misquoted on this, but it's why I think of it as an intelligence. I think of it as your strangest, most capable, yet also most flaky colleague. And if you think of it as a colleague, if you think of it as another person, you know, most people, most of the time, frankly, are full of shit on most topics. And most people take most things that most other people say with a pinch of salt. We have to have those checks and balances. We have to get away from this technology is always accurate. Technology always has the answer. You know, what's the Arthur C. Clarke quote? Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Well, that's never been more applicable than it is with AI. We have to somehow build in the checks and balances, build in the skepticism, build in the pinch of salt. It could be brilliant. It could be 2 hours in strawberry. And that, I think, is the huge challenge that every individual, every organization, and every society faces as we go about adopting AI.
I want to ask you a question about AI and jobs. I think maybe many people, you know, who are listening to this in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, who have careers to worry about, jobs to worry about, families, mortgages, commitments, credit card debt, medical debt, if you live in the United States. So I want to ask about that. But before that, I want to say something about the book, which will either irritate the shit out of people or attract them to it. We use sci-fi quite a lot. I don't know how many different sci-fi things we refer to. I mean, there's a lot of Greek mythology and stuff like that in it as well. So we're not just sci-fi, completely sci-fi nerds, but we use a lot of examples. And why is that? It's because starting back, Isaac Asimov wrote the Three Laws of Robotics in 1947. That was pretty ahead of its time. If you think about where robotic technology and artificial intelligence were in 1947, it wasn't even a twinkle in the eye of the guys who were going to meet at Dartmouth in 9 years' time. And science fiction has created these alternative worlds with super intelligences or super empowered beings a long time. And it's begun to do some of the, because we're in speculative territory. Like nobody really knows, right? What happens if we develop super intelligence? Will it be benign or not? I'd like to believe there's no necessary reason for it to be evil, but there's no necessary reason for it to be good either. So science fiction has called upon us to ask some of these questions and it's begun to think them through. So we throw in examples for that. We either find charming examples, quotations from the agents in the Matrix who call humanity a virus that's spreading itself on the planet, destroying hard habitats and all of that kind of stuff. So we leave that to you. We find that entertaining. I dare say there'll be people. Star Trek is a post-scarcity society. So Captain Picard says, money is no longer the object of human existence. We exist to better ourselves and to further art and science or something like that. You know, it's like, oh, okay. we don't work for money anymore. A so-called, what's called post-scarcity society. And one way of looking at human existence, going back 100,000 years or longer, is that it's been a fight over scarcity of resources, or control of resources. Today, it's control over capital more than many things, but it's also control over oil and control over water and control over breathable air, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. So control over resources. Well, what if we didn't have to fight over resources anymore? What if we were in this post-scarcity world? What would that make possible? I'm going to over to you now, because that's a little shout out for the sci-fi aspect of the book for fellow nerds. What should somebody be thinking? Your mid-career, your mid to early career, this thing, you don't know whether to pay attention to. You hear all the hype and all the bullshit on LinkedIn, you know, is that. And then you hear the doomers on LinkedIn, you know, the side. You hear Gary Marcus says this thing's full of shit. And it's, you know, they're talking out their backsides. Who do you believe? Question. That's a good question. And secondly, what do you do? Like, you know, this person, you know, maybe you're using a little bit of ChatGPT for recipes and travel planning and answering emails or whatever you use it for. How should you be positioning yourself? What's going to happen in the world of jobs? We're hearing 100 million jobs losses. That's a lot. I mean, to put it in perspective, I think the job losses during the 2008 downturn, it's in the book. It's tens of millions, not hundreds of millions, right? It's that kind of order of magnitude more. It's a lot of people without work. So, James, what's the take? Should they be worried? What should they do?
So, I'll answer this in a couple of different ways. Firstly, I think it's worth pointing out, as we do in the book, that this is not a new idea. This is not a new fear, nor is it a new hope. Now, various people have made this prediction over the centuries, but I'll name three: Benjamin Franklin, Karl Marx, John Maynard Keynes. Three people of very different backgrounds, very different political leanings, but all three of them over the last 200, 250 years have made this bold prediction that new technology would eradicate or reduce scarcity to the extent that we would not need to work very much. I think Keynes said 95 years ago that by 2030, we'd all be working 2 days a week. Marx went further and said that, you know, capitalism would bring about the end of scarcity. No one would need to work. We could all fish in the morning and hunt in the afternoon and criticize after dinner. None of these things have come true. None of these things have come true. And why is that? Well, I would argue it's very simply because human wants have increased in parallel with or in excess of human capabilities. So the standard of living, right? The standard of living in Western developed countries, you know, for moderately wealthy people, is astronomically higher than it was 100 years ago. It's astronomically higher than it was 200 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, the Luddites were destroying looms in 19th century Britain. There has always been this kind of anti-technology, this fear of technology, this fear that technology will take away jobs. That might happen this time.
They've been right historically, right? I mean, they've not been wrong.
And I think the challenge is that when you look back over 100, 200 years, it all comes out in the wash. And you say, well, in the long run, you know, actually we found new jobs, new types of employment were created that replaced those jobs. And that's all very well if you look at the level of a society. If you're one of the loom workers who loses their job, do you requalify as something else? I don't know that you do. It's sticky. And so at an individual level, this may be similar. If I'm honest, my biggest fear is not that. My biggest fear is that basically we use this technology like every previous technology to automate the wrong stuff.
You're right.
And yeah, work expands to fill the time available. We automate things that take us a lot of time at the moment. We just do more of them. My biggest fear from a worker perspective is that we send a lot more emails. We have a lot more meetings. We communicate a lot more. But the question is, if I write some bullet points and get my AI to turn those bullet points into an email, which I then send to you, and you use your AI to convert that and summarize it into some bullet points, what was the fucking point of any of it?
Right. Summarizing pointless emails, you know, sort of another mindless meeting. Okay, we've got an AI summary. That's awesome.
Well, I just think one of the biggest problems with meeting culture at the moment is you always invite too many people. Someone crucial doesn't turn up. You then have that thing about, well, should we go ahead with the meeting anyway? Okay, well, let's go ahead, but we'll need to catch up Paul later. And, you know, well, everyone now has the meeting summary thing. It's one of the use cases which I think has got most traction in the corporate world early on. It makes it a lot easier to have pointless meetings. It makes it a lot easier to skip out on meetings. Well, I don't need to attend that because I can just read the AI summary later. When you add all of these decisions up, does it make a more effective, more efficient culture? Or does it just make it easier to do the wrong things badly?
We can do the wrong things faster.
Right? We're going to drown in this. I think we're already drowning in this world of AI slop, just crappy content that gets produced really quickly.
Hey, what's the title of your book you're playing with, by the way? I know you changed the title recently.
BS at Work.
Yeah, there you go. That's a winner right there.
Where BS could be bullshit. It could also be behavioral science, but there we go.
There you go. Well, look for that in January 2026, people. But for now...
For now, adopting AI, the people-first approach, it's out on Monday. I think if you're listening to this, it's probably already Monday or later in the world. So please buy the book, review the book, share the book. We want to start a conversation. We want to start people thinking about how we as organizations and societies can better adopt AI and what it means.
Yeah. And as all authors are concerned, there's a state of the authorial process where basically you do nothing but blather on about the book until people are sick of hearing you. So if you're not sick of hearing from us yet and you're interested in a webinar or a keynote speech or a conference or a workshop for your team or, you know, something like that, you know, there's a period of time when James and I are going to be out there in the world doing this day in and day out. So feel free to ask if that's something that would be valuable to your community or your team or your organization, for sure. So you wanted to start this with one of the questions you sent me in advance was, are we doomers or Kool-Aid drinkers? So which is it? Come on.
I'm firmly on the fence.
Yeah, me too. In the wrong hands, this thing's nasty. That's for sure. Yeah, you'll see the doomsday scenarios, which are in the preface. And we invite you right now, if you get a copy of the book, when you get the preface, you know, a lot of people like skip the preface. It's short, 3 pages. So maybe take a minute with that and look at those scenarios and ask yourself where you think we are. Are we now tilted more towards the utopian end of the 7 scenarios? Things going in the right direction? Or are we tilted more maybe in the other direction? How fast are we speeding towards one future or the other? Come to your own view. You know, which way is all this heading right now? And that's kind of the backdrop for the book. I think a lot of the people, I wrote a blog about this that nobody has responded to or criticized yet. So either they're ignoring it or something. There's this idea that technology by itself is bad or good or evil, smart or dumb, and any of that kind of stuff. No, really, more of it lies in the hand of the user, the individual user, but also the corporate user, but also the uses that we point it towards in society. So I don't know. I'd like to be hopeful, right? I mean, I think it's hard to say you're hopeful with the world such a mess right now, but I'm hopeful that this will allow us to make the sort of breakthroughs that will allow us to rise above some of the petty nationalist politics of the 21st century. There you go.
Wouldn't that be great? I think on that truly utopian note, I think it's time to say thank you, Paul. Thank you for joining me again, and thank you, listeners.
Good to talk.
I'm often asked why someone focused on applying behavioral science to organizations would write a book about AI. I hope it's obvious from my conversation with Paul that I'm fascinated by the parallels and the similarities between human intelligence and artificial intelligence. It says something really profound about human nature that we've devoted so much effort over so long to essentially replicate ourselves, and that having now almost succeeded in that endeavor, just like Shelley's Frankenstein, many of us are appalled at what we've created. Biases, unpredictability, an opaque black box of reasoning we can't understand. We already had all of this in the 3 pounds of grey meat between our ears. And yet, we went ahead and built it anyway. The tragic irony is that we're so used to computer systems built on symbolic logic and coldly rational deterministic reasoning that most of us now imagine that's how our brains work. When confronted by this facsimile of how they actually work, we're horrified. But these aren't just theoretical, philosophical musings. They have huge practical implications. We can't effectively adopt AI if we don't grasp the central fact that it's not like the computer systems we're all used to. We all take it as read that humans are prone to biases and unpredictability, that we can never truly understand much of our own reasoning, let alone anyone else's. And that much of what many of us say is
best taken with a pinch of salt. AIs aren't human. Perhaps they're not even truly intelligent. But if we want to make the most of their huge potential, we need to start treating them like they are, flaws and all.